I'll read a quick disclaimer as we wait for all participants to join the call. Members of the media are not invited to participate. Any publication, distribution, reproduction, posting, sharing, or transmission of this information without the express permission of TD Securities is prohibited. As a reminder, we are not interested in receiving, ensuring, or disclosing any confidential information. In the event that you inadvertently disclose such information, please notify us as soon as possible. I will now turn the call over to our TD Cowen host, Phil Nadeau, to kick it off. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca, and welcome everyone. Thanks for joining this chat with Al Sandrock, the President and CEO of Voyager Therapeutics. We're hoping today to cover kind of two broad topics. One is Voyager's own programs and get an update on those. And then second, as many of you are aware, Al's been deeply involved in the development of drugs for Alzheimer's for decades. So with some notable events coming up, particularly in July, we're hoping to get his opinion on the current landscape. So Al, maybe I'll kick it to you to start. Could you give us a brief state of the company overview on Voyager? You sent a very interesting letter to shareholders to kick off the year. With the year half over, perhaps give us a progress report.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Phil, and it's a pleasure to talk to you. Sure, yeah, we sent this letter to shareholders, to stakeholders, we said. There were three parts to it. The first was that this was we thought this was going to be a transformative year for tau, and it is shaping up to be that way. We have our own two tau assets on track, and I know we'll talk more about that in a minute. The second piece was that we were going to be validating our brain-targeted capsids in humans, and we're on track for that too. In fact, one of those is the tau asset, the tau knockdown gene therapy. And then our partners at Neurocrine have indicated that they plan to dose the first patient in the FA gene therapy trial this year. And by the way, I should say that the 1706 tau knockdown gene therapy, we just announced that the FDA cleared our IND, so we're good to go in the clinic, and we're planning to enroll the first patient in the second half of this year, so that's on track. And then finally, on our shuttles, you know, we said we're going to be demonstrating the value of the shuttles. We're continuing to study the shuttles in vivo this year in NHPs. We're going to characterize the safety profile with our first of the shuttles, the ALPL-directed shuttle. So stay tuned on that. But so far, I'm feeling pretty optimistic.
In the letter, you called 2026 the year of tau. Can you discuss why this year is important for the tau field and maybe go into a little bit more detail why it's important for tau's for Voyager's own tau programs in particular?
Yeah, so I do think that the next stage of disease-modifying therapies is going to be based on tau. You know, we know we have, you know, look, we made a breakthrough a few years ago in the sense that we had the very first disease-modifying treatments, the anti-amyloids, but on average, they're about 25 to 30% effective on the CDR sum of boxes, which is the registrational endpoint that FDA essentially requires for disease-modifying treatments. So there's still a long way to go to really help the patients. And I think tau is going to be at least part of the solution for that. And I think this year is the year of tau because we have a pretty big readout coming out on BIIB080. BIIB080 is the Biogen antisense oligonucleotide that decreases the expression of tau, all forms of tau. And they announced in a press release that they had failed on the primary endpoint, but that all doses were effective. So I think the failure was due to the dose response statistic that they had. But we're going to see the data in mid-July at the AAIC, and I expect to see pretty interesting results. You know, I don't think they would have moved this program into phase three, which is not an inexpensive proposition if you include not only the phase three trials, but also the manufacturing required. That's a big investment. And so I see that as a positive indication, but we'll have to wait for the data to be to know more. And then, you know, for ourselves, we have our gene therapy, which could be a once and done IV treatment that is similar in terms of mechanistic effects on tau to the BIIB080. And then we have our own tau antibody 7523 that we are still expecting at on track. We still expect to see the tau PET imaging efficacy data in the second half of this year.
Great. Diving into each of those programs first, I think maybe we'll start with 7523, the antibody move to 1706, and then talk about Biogen in a bit of detail towards the end. But I guess first on VY7523, can you describe the design of that for those less familiar? What part of the tau molecule does it bind, and how could it be differentiated from other tau antibodies that have been in development?
Yeah, so the main thing is that it's differentiated on two points. One, the epitope. We have a C-terminal epitope, and all the other antibodies targeted different epitopes, either N-terminal or mid-domain. And so, and the only other company that I know of that's targeting the C-terminal epitope is Merck, and they have announced that they're moving from phase one to phase two, but the data that we've seen so far is mostly on the N-terminal and mid-domain. So that's one differentiation. And also, we have a specificity for pathological forms of tau, which I think could turn out to be important. If you bind to normal forms of tau, non-pathologic, you may have less drug available to target the pathological forms. For the anti-amyloid antibodies, it turned out to be pretty darn important that they were specific for pathological forms of amyloid. So the same might apply here.
Can you briefly review the preclinical data that support the development of 7523?
Yeah, so this was basically based on an empirical finding. So we had made over 700 antibodies against all sorts of epitopes on the tau molecule. And so how do you choose which one to move forward with? So the first thing was we said, let's choose an antibody that's specific for pathological forms of tau. But we still had about a half a dozen antibodies that were specific for pathological forms at various epitopes along the molecule. So how do you choose among those half dozen? So we chose to use this animal model where a transgenic mouse is expressing human tau. And into that mouse, you inject into the brain Alzheimer's disease-derived pathological tau. So it's rich in paired helical filaments, which come from the neurofibrillary tangles in Alzheimer's brain. And so we take human pathological tau, inject it into a mouse expressing human tau, and we say, does the antibody block the spread of pathological tau in that animal, both within the same region that you inject, but also across the brain, for example, on the contralateral side to other regions? And because that is what happens in humans, that you get spread of pathological tau out of the temporal cortex into other areas of the cortex. And we chose the antibody we chose, the C-terminal antibody 7523, because it was the best at blocking that spread. Now, you might say, well, why rely on an animal model? Well, we had no other way of really choosing which of the antibodies would be the best. And the other thing is that I gained more and more confidence in this model as it started to correctly predict the human results. So, for example, the N-terminal antibodies that failed in the clinic, both of them failed in this animal model to block the spread of tau. Moreover, bepranemab, the one antibody that does block the spread by about 60% or so, the UCB antibody, that does block the spread in this model. Not quite as well as our antibody, but it does block the spread. So we predicted that it would block the spread, and certainly it did. And then we also had looked at in our hands the J&J antibody, and we actually had an antibody right near the same epitope, and we chose not to pursue it because it did not block the spread of pathological tau in that model. So it's four for four in terms of predicting the human results, and so we'll see if it holds true with our antibody, but. So far, that animal does seem to predict the effect of antibodies on the spread of pathological tau in human Alzheimer's brain.
7523 is currently in a phase one single ascending dose, multiple ascending dose trial. Can you review the design of that study and summarize the results that have been released to date?
Yeah, so actually we already completed the single ascending dose study. That was a normal healthy volunteer study where the primary endpoints were safety and pharmacokinetics. We did find that it was well tolerated across all six ascending dose cohorts, and there were no serious adverse events or severe adverse events or infusion reactions. So we were very pleased with the safety and tolerability profile. Moreover, when we looked at the serum concentrations, it did increase in a dose proportionate manner. And the CSF to serum ratio was 0.3%, exactly where we would have thought. We said between 0.1 and 0.5%. So very typical of monoclonal antibodies in terms of the ability to get into the brain. And so having seen those results in the single ascending dose study in the healthy volunteers, we did enroll in a separate study, the multiple ascending dose study, which is going to read out, as I said, in the second half of this year. In that study, we are looking at tau PET imaging as the primary endpoint, and we're also going to look at some other fluid-based biomarkers in tau. So, and by the way, the PK was also in line with other monoclonal antibodies in the single ascending dose study. It was 22 to 29 days, which supports the monthly dosing that we're using in the MAD portion of the study.
What do you need to see from the tau PET and the tau biomarkers to advance 7523 to the next stage of development?
Yeah, we want to see an effect that is at least as good as bepranemab, and we'd love to see it be better than the effect of bepranemab, because bepranemab, failed to hit on the primary endpoint on the CDR sum of boxes. Although I should remind everybody that it did have a p value less than 0.05 on ADAS-Cog, the cognitive endpoint, in the overall population, not a subgroup. So there was evidence of efficacy on cognitive endpoints with bepranemab. We'd love to see an effect on tau PET imaging that's at least as good as bepranemab before we'd want to move forward with it.
And what would be the next steps for the program? Would you conduct a phase two similar to UCB and Biogen, or would it be possible to move directly into a potentially pivotal phase two, three?
Well, look, we've always said that Alzheimer's disease is probably too big for Voyager to go it alone. So we're going to immediately look for a partner. But conceptually, what you could do is go to a phase two, three trial, and pick the dose, pick a dose, and based on the multiple ascending dose study. And move forward into a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial.
Great. Moving to VY1706, can you discuss the structure of 1706?
Yeah, 1706 is an AAV gene therapy, so it employs a capsid that comes from our TRACER platform, a brand new novel capsid that is designed to cross the blood-brain barrier after intravenous delivery. And the payload is a vectorized siRNA. So the siRNA will decrease the expression of all forms of tau. So mechanistically, very similar to BIIB080, which is an antisense oligonucleotide that decreases the expression of all forms of tau. So this is a pioneering science. I mean, it's a BBB penetrant capsid, IV delivery, and it's a one-time treatment. And what we've seen is that we can get knockdown similar to what Biogen has seen with their antisense oligonucleotide. So we, you know, this is obviously because it's pioneering. We want to be sure that we do this safely. And so we've had close communication with FDA. We had a pre-IND meeting. Then we also had a Type C meeting. And of course, you can expect, that we had a pretty robust discussion around the IND itself. And as I said earlier, I'm happy to say that the FDA has cleared us to enter the clinic, and we plan to do so in the second half of this year.
How much scrutiny did the FDA put on the capsid itself? Is the FDA comfortable with capsids being delivered to the brain, and in particular, engineered blood-brain barrier-targeted capsid? Does that did that raise any concerns with the FDA, or is it relatively standard, the review process?
Well, no, FDA was very careful, asked a lot of actually very good questions. We, for example, talked about the fact that we knew the receptor. It's ALPL. We talked about the fact that it's different from the receptor that's ever been seen, tried before with any other BBB penetrant capsid. They asked a lot of interesting questions about off-target effects, et cetera, et cetera. So no, I mean, FDA was very, very careful, scrutinized the safety, and also had a lot of very good input on how to design our phase one trial properly so that we properly monitor for safety. Do you want me to tell you a bit about the phase one design, or?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, so what we're currently planning is a multi-site open label dose escalation study and up to 18 patients across three dose cohorts. And the highest dose is not going to exceed 5E13 VGs per kg. So the reason why we mentioned that is that we've always said that we didn't want to get up to the E14 VGs per kg range, which is where people have seen problems with systemically delivered IV, with AAV, right? So we're well below that at 5E13 at the highest dose. And of course, since it's a three cohorts dose escalation, we're going to obviously start at even lower doses. They're going to be adult patients with early Alzheimer's disease, and we're going to be making sure that they have tau. A pathological tau in the brain confirmed by tau PET imaging. The primary endpoint, of course, is going to be safety and tolerability, but we're also going to be looking at the effect on tau biology, which would include fluid-based outcome measures, such as CSF biomarkers of tau, and then also looking at the spread of pathological tau by tau PET imaging. So the way I think about this study and how it's going to read out, the first piece of information we'll get is acute safety. Is the drug safe after giving it IV? As we all know, the capsid clears from the body pretty rapidly. So we'll be looking at acute safety. The second stage is, do we have evidence of gene expression? And for that, we're going to rely on CSF biomarkers. And then finally, do we have proof of concept that the asset could be effective for helping patients with Alzheimer's disease? And for that, we're going to be focusing on tau PET imaging. And what we're hoping to do is to bridge to the BIIB080 data. BIIB080 will tell us the relationship between effects on tau PET imaging and clinical outcomes. And we'll learn a lot about that in July, I think, at the AAIC. So now what we hope to do is see whether we can achieve similar effects on tau PET imaging with our gene therapy.
Great. Maybe taking a step back, ahead of the BIIB080 data, what is the evidence that mRNA silencing or silencing of tau can reverse the course of tauopathies once aggregation has begun? Is there anything compelling either from the genetics or preclinical development?
Well, I think there's a lot of really interesting human data that suggests that tau pathology is key. First of all, the staging of Alzheimer's disease actually is based on where tau is spreading. And so what that means is that the worsening in clinical outcomes is actually better correlated with tau pathology than it is with any other biomarker. The second is that we have very clear-cut examples of patients who can have a brain full of amyloid, but without pathological spread of tau, they seem to be relatively immune to that or resistant to that buildup of amyloid in the brain. So they may still have cognitive impairment, but very, very delayed, or sometimes no evidence of cognitive impairment at all. So it does look like amyloid by itself is not necessarily enough to cause cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease patients. And in fact, the main role of amyloid might be to trigger tau pathology. So that's the human biology evidence. But I would say that one of the most compelling pieces of data come from the phase one data that Biogen has showed and now published by Melanie Schulman and colleagues very recently. What it shows is that with BIIB080, which lowers the, which decreases expression of tau, you actually remove pathological tau from the brain. So you get a decrease in tau PET signal relative to baseline. Very different, actually, from the antibody bepranemab, which blocks the spread of tau but doesn't necessarily remove it from where it had pre-existed. So that's a fundamentally different result, that you actually remove pathological tau from the brain in areas where there was it was present at baseline. And then what you see is a clinical effect that seems pretty interesting. Now, the issue with the phase one study was that there was no placebo group, there was no control group. So you have to then do cross-trial comparisons. And what Biogen did was they compared it to another study called the TANGO study, which had enrolled patients roughly contemporaneously with the BIIB080 study. And they used propensity score matching to find a population in the placebo-treated patients that matched the BIIB080-treated patients. And what they saw was a pretty big effect size, if you can believe cross-trial comparisons. And we have to always take that with a bit of a grain of salt. But the effect size was quite large, you know, as large as 2 points on the CDR sum of boxes, which, when you compare to the anti-amyloids, which are about a 0.5 effect size, that's a much bigger treatment effect. So we'll see if that's confirmed in the placebo-controlled randomized trial setting, as we'll see at the AAIC. But if that's true, then we could be seeing efficacy better than we see with the anti-amyloids.
Two questions on 1706. First, I forgot to ask you, when could data be available from the phase one, when the initial data as well as the tau PET data? And then second, any thoughts on using the 1706 in combination with 7523?
Yeah, so, you know, in terms of when we're going to see data, you know, I look on it as I said, three sort of pieces of information: acute safety, which, you know, should be, you know, if the patients are fine after a couple of weeks of treatment, that's, I think, big news. I think it'll be the first time that we can use a BBB penetrant capsid that can be safely used in humans. Then the next would be fluid-based biomarkers that could see where we could see evidence of gene expression. And for that, we're going to need some more time. As I said, assay proof of concept, which is 12-month tau PET imaging. So that'll be later. So three different stages. And the timing is going to be based on how well we enroll, how rapidly we enroll. So I'm not giving out timelines quite yet, but you can imagine that it's going to be, you know, over the next 18, 20, you know, 24 months, I would say.
Great. As we transition into some of the other molecules in the field, I just kind of want to get a little bit more of your thoughts on comparing and contrasting the modalities. So we have ASOs, siRNA, and antibodies all directed against tau. You touched a little bit about on how the siRNA versus antibodies differ. Any thoughts on pluses and minuses of each of those modalities more generally?
Yeah, so with antibodies, you know, you have to be sure you choose the right epitope. Antibodies don't, we don't think, get inside cells appreciably. So we're trying to capture the pathological tau as it's spreading from one cell to another. And in our case, we have a antibody that's specific for pathological tau, forms of tau. So very different than an antisense or an siRNA approach where, you know, there's no epitope that's involved. You knock down all forms of tau, both the non-pathologic as well as the pathologic forms. And then it's intracellular as well as extracellular tau. So just I think you it's a you know you hit tau much harder, if you will, with the antisense and siRNA approach. But the data that we're going to see this summer should tell us whether that's a safe approach and whether or not it portends for better efficacy.
Great. I should say, if anyone has additional questions, please email them to me, philip.nato@tdsecurities.com, and I'd be happy to ask Al on your behalf. So, moving to that data this summer, I guess, and there are pluses and minuses based on our interpretation. The positive is that there was robust tau biomarker reduction and a signal on cognition. So, that was the first in the tau class. The lack of dose response on CDR-SB and limited data detail did leave a lot of questions. So I think we're all looking forward to AAIC in July. Maybe by way of background, can you remind us of the role you played in guiding the Ionis collaboration in the initial development of diranersen? I believe that the Ionis collaboration was expanded to include Alzheimer's under your leadership when you're head of R&D at Biogen. Can you remind us what role you played here?
Yeah, well, I championed the initial collaboration with them on Spinraza for spinal muscular atrophy, and then I was an internal champion for that. I was chief medical officer at the time, and then when we thought about expanding, I was chief medical officer, and as you can imagine, I was a big fan of that. It was partly because the science was great. It was enough, we could address targets with a brand new modality, but also I really respected the scientists at Ionis, and I thought, you know, great science done by great people, and we had and we could address targets that we couldn't address before with small molecules or even biologics. I was a big fan of that collaboration. I was, you know, I also, I think I was, I forget whether I was head of R&D or CMO when we brought BIIB080 into the clinic. I was a champion of that approach as well.
Great. I think the key question that investors are debating as we head into AAIC is whether diranersen's impact on cognition is a true biologic effect and the chances it will succeed in a phase III trial that has a cognitive primary endpoint. On a high level, how are you thinking about those questions and how would you use the data to present at AAIC to inform the answers?
Yeah, so you know the data is it's going to be a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial with three different doses. What we know is that it did not hit on the primary endpoint, which was a dose-response statistic. There's some risk, you know. Biogen took a bit of a risk in with using that statistic because you know the CDR sum of boxes is a highly variable endpoint, right? And we know that the sample size, the lowest dose had the smallest sample size relative to the other two doses. Moreover, if you look at the phase one data, even though there was a separation between dose groups early on, ultimately the dose groups kind of come together, if you will. So by 18 months, even the lower doses start to catch up, if you will. And so the dose response statistic was a bit of a gamble. But I think they did that because the sample size had been reduced from the original sample size, which was I think twice as large. So maybe that's why. I mean, I wasn't there when they made all these decisions, so I'm speculating, Philip. But anyway, but I think it was a. So what we heard is that all doses showed an effect on cognitive outcomes. That's what I read in the press release. I think I also saw the word compelling in there somewhere. And so what I'm thinking is that maybe they were on the flat part of the dose response curve, if you will, and that could actually be bad if you have a dose response statistic. If all doses look similar, then you're not going to hit on that endpoint. And maybe that's what we'll see. And if you think, well, if you're on the flat part of the dose response curve, there's a one-third chance that any of those dose response do those dose groups sort of look superior to the other, right? I mean, just by chance alone. So I'm not even certain that there's an inverted dose response, because there was some hint that I think the lowest dose might have been the most effective. That could have been just due to chance if they're on the flat part of the curve and they're all roughly the same in terms of efficacy. Remember that that lowest dose also is the smallest sample size, so I bet the error bars are bigger there. So I think I bet I suspect that there's no statistically significant difference between dose groups is the point I'm trying to make, I guess. That's what I'm thinking. And then, of course, what we heard was that there may have been some more adverse events at the highest dose. And in the history of Alzheimer's trials, for example, if you remember the gamma secretase inhibitors and even some of the beta secretase inhibitors trials, some of the adverse events associated with those drugs affected cognition. So if you had more adverse events in the highest dose that affect cognition, then that could make that highest dose look less efficacious, right? So I'm going to be checking to see whether the adverse events had it had could have had any effect on cognition itself. There's
Is
no
there
evidence of that in the phase one trial, but you never know. But when you have larger, when you have a larger study.
a particular magnitude of CDR-SB change that would convince you the change is real? Or is it is something too small? Is there a threshold, or I don't know, is it more about the consistency among the data? What
Yeah, and on that, I prefer to use the percentage. You notice how I said 25 to 30% effect for the anti-amyloids. The reason why I don't use the absolute values like 0.5 or 2 on the sum of boxes to answer this question is that the number, if you use the absolute value, it depends a lot on what happens in the placebo group. And that can vary from trial to trial, depending on the population that you choose, right? So if you say percentage effect size, you can compare across trials, if you will, and compare across populations. So having said that, I think we all want to see something north of 25% for sure. North of 30% would be even better. Because we don't want something that's identical to the anti-amyloids in effect size, right? We want something that's better. Of course, if it works in people who don't respond to anti-amyloids at all, then even a 25 or 30% effect size is still meaningful. But I'd love to see an effect size that's north of 30%. Whether we'll see that or not, I have no idea.
And on the placebo group in particular, what rate of decline in CDR-SB would you anticipate over 76 weeks? Like, what would be a normally acting placebo group? Is there any way to know that without looking at the baseline characteristics stuff?
It should be pretty comparable because the population is similar to the anti-amyloid trials, so it should be comparable to that. But I would say that I don't think you have to worry about that if you just use the percentage difference from placebo as your primary endpoint. And in fact, that's what's in the FDA labels. If you look at donanemab, it's 22% on CDR sum of boxes. I think for lecanemab, it's I think 27%, something like that. So that's why I say the, but I would expect it to be comparable, sort of the 0.5 to 5 to 1 range.
Got it. In terms of the difference between the doses, it could be random, as you suggested. Biogen suggested it's possible that the essential functions of the tau protein for microtubule function are inhibited too much at the higher doses, suggesting that knockdown past a certain threshold could be disrupting cellular homeostasis. Is that a possible explanation, or do you think it's more likely just random noise?
Yeah, so if you look at knockout animals, for example, they actually are fairly normal up until they get older. So, you know, they survive full knockout. They survive. They're actually fertile. But you see some abnormalities as they get into the older age. And there's some view that that tau, which is a microtubule-associated protein, is important stabilizing microtubules. And so that's why I mentioned earlier I'm going to be checking to see whether or not some of the adverse events had something to do with cognition. In other words, they affected neuronal function. Could they have affected neuronal function in some way? I don't know that that's what we're going to see, but I would say that we're all kind of shying away from 100% knockdown. Remember, the knockout animals are 100% knockdown, right? So, you know, Biogen, I think, was targeting somewhere between 50 and 80%, and we're targeting the similar range because I think we're all nervous about knocking it down 100%, if you will.
And we discussed the CDR-SB endpoint. How are you going to assess the other cognitive endpoints that were included in the study? Can you describe kind of the type of data that will make you more confident in Diranersen's effect, and also what type of data would make you less confident?
Yeah, so you know, so there's complexity there. So I keep talking about CDR sum of boxes because that was the primary endpoint. And it is has been traditionally the endpoint required by FDA for disease modifying treatments for Alzheimer's disease. And that's because it's a mixture of cognitive and outcomes and functional outcomes. So there's six subscales, three cognitive and three functional on the CDR sum of boxes. What I read in the press release was that it had an effect on cognitive endpoints. I don't know what that means. Does that mean that it didn't have an effect on the functional subscales of CDR sum of boxes or what? I don't know. You know, maybe I'm reading too much into the press release, you know. But ADAS-Cog is a purely cognitive endpoint, and that's a tried and true endpoint. Remember, all the cholinesterase inhibitors and memantine were approved based on ADAS-Cog as the primary endpoint. So that's a validated endpoint for cognition. So I'll be looking at that and see if they're and see, you know, if they show the data on the subscales of CDR, was there more of an effect on the cognitive endpoints? And do you see that confirmed with ADAS-Cog? The other things that I'm going to be very interested to see is the effect on what I would call more functional outcomes. And one of the best measures of that are the activities of daily living, the ADLs. And there are ADL scales that are sort of tailored for this population, the MCI, mostly the MCI and early dementia patients. And so those are things like, you know, activities of daily living, can they function independently, essentially, and there's various subscales of that. Though that's going to be of interest to me. You know, in the case of the anti-amyloids, they had a bigger effect on ADL scales than on the cognitive scales. And to me, you know, I mean, if you talk about what's meaningful for patients, it's the ability to live independently, right? And so I think that's a pretty important piece to look at. So we'll have to see whether there's a difference, if you will, between cognitive and functional, and these other scales will tell us a bit more about that.
I'd assume that you'd want to see some level of consistency among the different cognitive endpoints and similarly among the different functional endpoints in order to be more confident in that the data is real. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say so, but you know, I mean, look, cognitive endpoints are not unimportant, you know. So a drug that affects cognition is highly welcome, particularly if it slows the worsening in cognitive decline. My goodness, that's huge. But yeah, for that to happen and see no effect on functional endpoints that speak to whether or not they can live in relatively independently. That would be weird, right? I mean, you'd love to see consistency across both because they're both clinically meaningful to me, you know, and to the patients, right? And so, yeah, I guess, But could a drug have more an effect on cognition than on functional? Maybe. But I'd have to understand more why that's the case, because a lot of the functional endpoints are related to the ability to think clearly, right? And to have a fairly normal cognitive skills. So
I think we're all going to be focused on the cognitive and functional endpoints. Biogen has disclosed, however, that the treatment drove a robust and sustained reduction in both CSF tau and tau PET signal across the dose arms. Is there anything particularly you're looking for in the tau biomarker data itself? Is one measure more important than the other, or and what would I guess how will you evaluate that data?
yeah, so I have been I'm going to focus a lot more on the tau PET imaging than on any of the fluid-based biomarkers, because I'm not certain that any of the fluid-based biomarkers have reached the level of validation, if you will. For example, Biogen themselves presented, I think it was a year ago at AD/PD, that the Tango study, the anti-tau antibody that failed on tau PET imaging and on clinical outcome measures, it had a 40% effect on, I think it was MTBR tau, if I'm not mistaken, which was considered at the time to be the best of the fluid-based tau biomarkers. So it had a nice effect on the tau, and it had no effect on tau PET imaging or on clinical outcome measures. So right now, I have to say I'm going to focus a lot more on tau PET imaging than on the fluid-based biomarkers. I do think that the fluid-based biomarkers may tell you a little bit about target engagement, if you will, or at least how robustly the antisense decreases the expression of tau. I think that's important. But in terms of clinically relevant outcomes, I think the tau PET imaging is closer to that. And what I'm hoping, Phil, is to learn, what we haven't figured out, it took us many years to figure this out with the anti-amyloids, is how much of an effect on tau PET imaging do you need to see a clinically significant outcome? In the case of anti-amyloid, you'll recall it had to be a very robust decrease in amyloid plaque burden to see even a modest effect on clinical outcomes. Drugs that had some effect on reducing amyloid plaque burden actually did not have a very big effect at all on clinical outcomes. So you had to have a big effect on amyloid plaques to see any effect on clinical outcomes. I don't know if that's what the case is here with tau, but trying to understand the relationship between tau PET imaging and clinical outcomes is a pretty important thing for the field. And for me, that's what I'm going to try to really hope we understand more of at the AAIC meeting.
And on the adverse event profile, you noted some adverse events could have impacted cognition and that may have impacted the efficacy at the highest dose. What else about the safety profile will you pay attention to? Are there other SAEs or AEs that you would find particularly troubling?
Well, there are AEs associated with intrathecal antisense oligonucleotide administration. We saw, remember with tominersen, we saw some evidence of enlargement of the cerebral ventricles, and et cetera. So there are some sort of class effect, if you will, adverse events associated with intrathecal antisense oligonucleotides. There may be some inflammation in the spinal fluid, inflammatory markers going up with repeated intrathecal injections. Now, if the lowest dose is the most effective, fortunately for patients, it's only every 6 month dosing rather than every 3 months. So that's fantastic news. So I'll be looking at sort of class effect type adverse events. And then, of course, are there any adverse events that could be linked to the loss of tau function, of normal tau, not the pathological tau, but how much normal wild type tau do we need to retain in neurons for there to be no adverse effects? So I'll be looking for adverse effects that could tie in to that, to the function of normal tau in neurons. And then, tau is also expressed in other tissues. So, cardiac tissue, muscle. I don't expect anything to see any adverse events in those, but it's something that I myself will keep an eye on.
We'll get an email question that puts a nice bow on that the conversation we just had. And it is, could you ask Al his level of conviction that the community walks away from the detailed 080 data with the view that the drug is having a real and clinically relevant effect with an acceptable safety profile? So I guess how confident are you that that's her
Well,
conclusion leaving AAIC?
yeah, just keep in mind that I tend to be on the optimistic side, Phil. You've known me for years, and but I think the fact that they have decided to move to phase three, and Chris Viehbacher has not been shy about cutting programs, terminating programs, things that are not going to be commercially viable or helpful to patients. The fact that he and his team decided to move to phase three, that's I think we're gonna I think I'm gonna walk o I think I'm gonna walk away from AIC feeling pretty confident that we have an approach that could really help patients and be substantially, yeah, I think I'm gonna walk away thinking that they have a robust benefit risk profile. That's what I'm hoping anyway. But as I said, caveat is that I'm, some would say, ridiculously optimistic.
As you noted, Biogen is moving forward into a pivotal study. How would you design a registrational study for Darinersen? What do you think is the most appropriate endpoint? Would you use CDR-SB? Would it depend on what data we see in July?
Yeah, well, it's always a negotiation, that I'm sure they're going to have an end of phase two meeting with FDA, and there's going to be a discussion. The precedence, as we've seen now, is that FDA likes CDR sum of boxes because they always want to see effects on cognition and on function, and the CDR looks at both. So I don't know whether FDA will back off from that requirement. I doubt it. And I don't know whether Biogen's going to want them to back off. There may be a nice effect on CDR sum of boxes that, and so there would be no risk in having that as the primary endpoint. I think it's probably going to be an 18-month study, yeah, there's a certain requirement for safety database, but I think if you power the study to hit the at 90% power to hit the primary endpoint, you're probably going to have a nice, robust safety database as well. So, and then the FDA has some comfort around intrathecal antisense oligonucleotide treatments, right? There's already two that have been approved: Spinraza for SMA and tofersen for ALS. So it's not like it's the first; it would be the first in approved intrathecal ASO. I mean, the only difference here is that Alzheimer's disease and tau pathology is a cortical disease. It involves the cerebral cortex. I would say that SMA and tofersen are more spinal cord diseases. So since you inject the antisense intrathecally, there's a gradient, right? So the antisense has to go further, if you will, and maintain exposures that are high enough up in the cerebral cortex. But Biogen has showed quite nicely in the phase one trial that you get very robust effects on tau PET imaging in the cerebral cortex. So that gradient.